Tragedy has often been compared to Pearl Harbor. Here we have quotes from two different books on the subject. From Pearl Harbor, Mother of All Conspiracies. Everything the Japanese were planning to do was known to the United States. Army Board, 1944. And from the book Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt provoked the attack, knew about it in advance, and covered up his failure to warn the Hawaiian commanders. FDR needed the attack to sucker Hitler to declare war, since the public and Congress were overwhelmingly against entering the war in Europe. It was his back door to war.
New evidence now suggests that the Americans and the British knew a great deal more about the coming attack than has ever been officially admitted. There were 4,000 casualties in less than 90 minutes. The attack allowed President Roosevelt to take America into the war. On December 8, 1941, the United States of America declared war on Japan. 3 days later, Germany and Italy, in turn, declared war on the United States. For nearly 50 years, one question has been repeatedly asked. Did Roosevelt allow Pearl Harbor to happen so that the surprise attack would give him the excuse to take America into the Second World War? The new evidence that has come to light strongly suggests that he did. It is now clear that Roosevelt and his advisors knew far more than was openly admitted at any of the 9 separate inquiries into the attack. William Casey, a former director of the CIA, was in a position to testify where some of that information came from. In his book, Casey says quite openly that the British told the Americans that a Japanese fleet was heading east across the Pacific towards Hawaii. It is now known that Churchill used this intelligence to give British commanders in the Far East early warning of the imminence of a Japanese attack. But no similar warnings were ever sent from Roosevelt to the American commanders in the Pacific. This fact alone suggests a degree of culpability on the part of the president that cannot have been so strongly argued before now.
On October 7, 1940, Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum of the Office of Naval Intelligence submitted a memo to Navy Captains Walter Anderson and Dudley Knox, two of President Roosevelt's most trusted military advisors. The memo, scanned below, detailed an 8-step plan to provoke Japan into attacking the United States. President Roosevelt, over the course of 1941, implemented all 8 of the recommendations contained in the McCollum memo. Following the 8th provocation, Japan attacked. The public was told it was a complete surprise, an intelligence failure, and America entered World War II. After the December 7, 1941 Pearl Harbor attack, leading Republicans accused President Franklin Roosevelt of allowing, if not orchestrating, the attacks in order to take America into World War II. Republicans, including Thomas Dewey, the governor of New York and the GOP nominee for president in 1948, demanded to impeach FDR during the darkest days of World War II based on this conspiracy theory.
In this chaotic climate, and in an effort to reorganize the U.S. military, President Truman passed the National Security Act. This act built the framework for America's modern national security structure. Among other things, the act established the National Security Council and the CIA.
The National Security Act of 1947 allowed for the creation of a state within a state.
Richard Dolan asserts that the signing of the National Security Act created an intelligence infrastructure capable of maintaining a very high level of secrecy.
One with an enormous amount of power, an enormous amount of wealth, an enormous amount of secrecy, and latitude of action.
Whatever activity is going on, to the extent that it is a clandestine group, a quasi-government group, a quasi-private group, it is without any type, as far as I can tell, of high-level government oversight. And that is a great concern.
'50s were the decade when this thing went out of control. And Eisenhower knew it, and that is why he said,
in the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
In his farewell address to the nation, President Eisenhower cautioned the public about the relationship between the U.S. military and the industrial sector which supplies the military with weaponry and equipment. Eisenhower felt that if gone unchecked, the military-industrial complex would become too powerful.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
But I think he was telling us the military-industrial complex will stick you in the back if you are not totally vigilant. And I think he felt like he had not been vigilant. I think he felt like he trusted too many people.
Brigadier General Stephen Lufkin served under President Eisenhower in the White House Army Signaling Agency. He recalls Eisenhower's concern with the military-industrial complex.
He realized that he was losing control. He realized that the phenomenon of whatever it was that we were faced with was not going to be in the best hands, and that those were the, as far as I can remember, that was the expression that was used. It's not going to be in the best hands.
Who is running the show? How far has this thing gone? How much has this Frankenstein, this covert military-industrial sector, gotten its legs and gotten up off the table and walked away?
This next part of Historical Context examines the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. These assassinations are highly instructive about how secret operations are routinely carried out by hidden aspects of the U.S. military-industrial intelligence complex. In Oliver Stone's movie JFK, the character played by Donald Sutherland is a composite character but is based primarily on Colonel Fletcher Prouty, a consultant on the film.
It is so difficult to hear the true story, the accurate story, of the assassination of the president. People just don't realize, first of all, that the assassination of the president is a function of government around the world, whether they want to believe that or not, it is. And so to find that a man is killed by a professional hit team, and I'm not talking about Americans, I'm talking about a hit team that's stateless, that purposely trained to be stateless, that's part of the job. You can kill them with a gun easy. But next is, there has to be a cover story. There has to be a story that goes out that takes care of events so people will believe that story, as they've been trying to have us believe the story of Lee Oswald. But it takes more than that, because people keep asking questions, they have to keep putting the answers in there, and they have to be reasonable.
Emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Now this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Everything I'm going to tell you is classified top secret. I was a soldier, Mr. Garrett, in two wars. I was one of those secret guys in the Pentagon that supplies the military hardware with planes, bullets, rifles, for what we call black operations, black ops. Assassinations, coup d'etat, rigging elections, propaganda, psych warfare. World War II, I was in Romania, Greece, Yugoslavia. I helped evacuate part of the Nazi intelligence apparatus just before the end of the war. And we used those guys in the fight against the communists. In Italy, 48, we stole the elections. France, 49, broke the strikes. Overthrew Carino in the Philippines. Abdins in Guatemala. Mozadegh in Iran. We were in Vietnam in 54. Indonesia, 58, Tibet, 59, got the Dalai Lama oath. They were good. 1963. I spent much of September 63 working on the Kennedy plan for getting all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. This plan was one of the strongest, most important papers issued from the Kennedy White House. I was on my way back in New Zealand when the president was killed. Now, Oswald was charged at 7 p.m. Dallas time with Tippit's murder. That's 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the next day, New Zealand time. But already, their papers had the entire history of this unknown 24-year-old man, Oswald. Studio pictures, detailed biographical data, Russian information, and were pretty sure of the fact that he killed the president alone, although it took them 4 more hours before they even charged him with that crime in Dallas. It's up to me, is it? Well, a cover story was being put up, like we would in a black op. One of my routine duties, if I had been in Washington, would have been to arrange for additional security in Texas, so I decided to check it out. And sure enough, I found out that someone had told the 112th Military Intelligence Group at 4th Army Headquarters at Fort Sam Houston to stand down that day over the protests of the unit commander, Colonel Rush.
I believe it's a mistake.
This is significant because it is standard operating procedure, especially in a known hostile city like Dallas, to supplement the Secret Service. It was a violation of the most basic protection codes we have, and it is the best indication of a massive plot in Dallas. Now, who could have best done this? Black ops, Mr. Garrison, people in my business, people like my superior officer, could have called Colonel Reich and said, look, we have another unit coming from so-and-so, providing security, you'll stand down.
I never realized Kennedy was so dangerous to the establishment. Is that why?
Well, it's a real question, isn't it? Why? The how and the who is just scenery for the public. Oswald, Ruby, Cuba, the mafia. Keeps them guessing like some kind of parlor game, prevents them from asking the most important question, why? Why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? Who has the power to cover it up? Who? In 1961, right after the Bay of Pigs, very few people know about this, all right? I participated in drawing up National Security Action Memos 55, 56,
General?
57.
General,
these are crucial documents, classified top secret. But basically in them, Kennedy instructed General Lemnitz, chairman of the Joint
General,
Chiefs, that from here on forward, the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be wholly responsible for all covert paramilitary action in peacetime. This basically ended the reign of the CIA. Splintered it, as JFK promised he would, into 1,000 pieces, and now he was ordering the military to help him do it. This was unprecedented. I can't tell you the shockwaves that this sent along the corridors of power in Washington. The authority of the state over its people resides in its war powers. And Kennedy wanted to end the Cold War in his second term. He wanted to call off the moon race in favor of cooperation with the Soviets. He signed a treaty with the Soviets to ban nuclear testing. He refused to invade Cuba in 1962, and he set out to withdraw from Vietnam. But all of that ended
on the 22nd November 1963. It has no face, yet everybody in the loop knows.
I think it started like that, in the wind. Defense contractors, big oil bankers, just conversations, nothing more. Then a call is made.
Everything is cellularized. No one has said he must die. There's been no vote, nothing's on paper, no one to blame. It's as old as the crucifixion. No one's guilty, because everyone in the power structure who knows anything has a plausible deniability. There are no compromising connections except at the most secret point.
But what's paramount is that it must succeed. No matter how many die, no matter how much it costs, the perpetrators must be on the winning side and never subject to prosecution for anything by anyone. That is a coup d'etat.
The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. The people have so much to gain and have such an ulterior motive for putting in a position I'm in. We'll never let the true facts come aboard to the world.
Are these people in very high positions yet?
Yes.
We're not a free country anymore, because the people who are smart enough and powerful enough to take out a president like that and get away with it for 25 years are probably involved in other areas of the government. In other words, the country is being run by people we did not vote for.
Colonel Fletcher Prouty was Chief of Special Operations of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during Kennedy's presidency. He believes even more powerful forces were ultimately responsible.
With sufficient power to operate the cover-up ever after. Because you see, it's one thing to kill somebody. It's another thing to cover up the fact that you did it or that you hired somebody to do it. And that's more difficult. So they use the device of the Warren Commission report to cover up their hired killers. Now, who would hire the killers and who has the power to put the Warren Commission report out over the top of the whole story? You see, you're dealing with a very high echelon of power. It doesn't necessarily reside in any government. It doesn't necessarily reside in any single corporate institution, but it seems to reside in a blend of the two. Otherwise, how could you have gotten people like the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to participate in the cover-up, the police in Dallas to participate in the cover-up, etc., and the media? You know, all the media, not just one or two newspapers, but none of them will print the story that other than Oswald killed the president with three bullets, something that's absolutely untrue.
There can be the overthrow of a government, that there can be a coup d'etat in America, that in fact did happen through the assassination of President Kennedy. In order to prevent that kind of thing from happening again, in order to expose the forces that were responsible for that kind of murder and the kind of cover-up that has ensued in the following 25 years, it's necessary to expose it. Otherwise, we can have the same thing repeated again. Therefore, in the same fashion that we have exposed problems and scandals involved with Watergate, problems in Vietnam, problems in Central America, problems in the overthrow of governments elsewhere like Allende in Chile, and on and on and on, so must we expose that same kind of political assassination in our country. As painful as it may be, as disruptive as it might be in a transitory nature, as embarrassing as it might be to certain individuals and organizations in the United States government, that has to be uncovered.
The people who I think had most to gain as they saw it were the military industrial intelligence complex. It's a myth that the intelligence agents don't make policy. They make it all the time. They always say they're carrying out policy, and sometimes they are. The people who had most to gain were those who didn't want the peace in the world that John Kennedy had tried to turn the world toward when he and Khrushchev worked out the solution to the Cuban Missile Crisis. The people who didn't want John Kennedy to be president were those who were making incredible fortunes from war production. None of these things that the critics brought to light were treated responsibly by any responsible element of the press. Substantial criticism never had a voice. And that's what the working of a democratic society requires. Most of all, when it's a crime of the magnitude of the subversiveness of this one, the assassination of a president.
A handful of critics and researchers in this case have gotten remarkably far on their own. But if the press would just be honest about it and question and do their job, we could learn a lot more. The fact of the assassination conspiracy is beyond doubt. Only the scope is in question.
Most everyone knows that Dr. King was a courageous Christian minister committed to the nonviolent pursuit of freedom for all people. In this pursuit, he went to jail 29 times. Nothing new so far, but prepare yourself for some stunning surprises. James Earl Ray, a petty criminal who died in 1998, and who, according to the official story, shot Dr. King, in fact, did not shoot Dr. King, even though he pleaded guilty in 1969. That's right, James Earl Ray was not, absolutely without any question, not the killer. This footage of Dexter King shaking hands with James Earl Ray speaks volumes. Dexter and the other members of the King family have persevered ever since Dr. King's death to learn the truth about what happened and to make that truth known. They are convinced Ray was not the shooter. Ray's guilty plea comes about on the advice of a lawyer who approaches Ray and offers to represent him. It turns out this lawyer has connections with the true killers. The lawyer tells Ray that a guilty plea will make Ray famous and help him get off with a light sentence. Always easily led, Ray writes out what he's told to. And by the way, it's a guilty plea, not a confession. These facts are found in a book just out, the best single book on the assassination, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. On the basis of the guilty plea, Ray is sentenced to 99 years in prison. Ray realizes he's been duped. 3 days after arriving in the penitentiary, he moves for his guilty plea to be set aside and that he be given a trial. But stalling by government officials denies him that for the rest of his life. To his dying day, he insists he did not kill Dr. King. Pepper's book includes a full account of the extensive civil trial into Dr. King's death, held in Memphis, Tennessee in 1999. That there was such a trial may be a surprise to you also. The family suit names as defendants co-conspirators, both named and unknown. The trial's not about money. The family seeks $100 damages. The trial is about the truth. The trial lasts almost a month. 70 witnesses are heard. A jury of 6 black and 6 white persons takes just 1 hour to arrive at a guilty verdict against, quote, the co-conspirators, consisting of the named defendant, Lloyd Jowers, and those that the defendant named in his response, namely, the United States government, the state of Tennessee, the city of Memphis, and Memphis Police Department, James Earl Ray, Earl Clark, and Frank Liberto, unquote. Earl Clark, now deceased, was the top marksman in the Memphis Police Department. Frank Liberto was a mafia kingpin. Conspirators within the U.S. government, according to the trial and the book, include, quote, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, and the military, unquote. The reason all this information probably surprises you is that the mainstream media effectively boycotted the trial. As Pepper writes, the silence following these shocking revelations was deafening. Like the pattern during all the investigations of the assassination throughout the years, no major media outlet would cover the story. It was effectively buried. Just 6 of the many facts that come out at the trial. First, when King arrives in Memphis, he's taken not to his usual hotel, which is safe for him, but rather to another, and given a room he must reach by an exposed balcony readily visible from dense bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill across the street, and from various high vantage points. Second fact, a special security unit of black officers assigned to King on all his previous visits to Memphis is told it's not required this time. Third fact, defendant Jowers, former owner of Jim's Bar and Grill, admits to receiving and storing a gun the day before the killing, being handed a still-smoking gun the day of, and disposing of that gun. Fourth, U.S. Army snipers are positioned on 2 nearby rooftops and a water tower, not, as you'd expect, to protect King, but to back up the assassin in case he misses. He does not. Fifth fact, New York Times reporter Earl Caldwell is in a room close to King's. He comes out when he hears the shot. He and others testify for the trial that they saw a man crouching in the bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill. This man cannot be James Earl Ray. Reliable witnesses see Ray leave the area before the shot is fired. Fact 6. The day after the killing, early in the morning, a city works crew is sent to cut down and methodically remove the bushes and all debris from behind Jim's Bar and Grill. The order comes from the Memphis Police Department. Whoever killed King, it was not James Earl Ray. He could never have coordinated such a plan or assembled such a task force, and he wasn't at the scene. He is the fall guy. But the trial, in effect, is boycotted by the media. That's why you don't know about it. That's why I didn't know about it until 3 months ago, through James Douglas. King recognized that powerful economic forces stunt history and kill hope. It's important to understand that these powerful forces now include the mainstream media. To study Dr. Martin Luther King's nonviolent quest for social and economic justice as the surest foundation for peace is to recognize him not only as a civil rights leader, but as a man of the hour, even in these troubling days. King's life and death remain important news. A little historical perspective. Here are two important events, each reported and accepted as authentic fact at the time. Each was, in reality, an elaborate deception planned at the highest levels and executed to sway public opinion. August 2, 1964. In the Gulf of Tonkin, North Vietnamese torpedo boats attack the U.S. destroyer Maddox. The Associated Press story, for some reason, is datelined Pearl Harbor. The lead. Three PT boats, identified by Secretary of State Dean Rusk as North Vietnamese, attacked. Later, a second U.S. destroyer is attacked. Although no U.S. sailor suffers a scratch, the American public is outraged. President Lyndon Johnson goes on television to ask the country to support war action. 2 days later, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution is approved by the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously, then by the Senate, 88-2. The resolution becomes the entire justification for the United States war against Vietnam. Before that's over, 58,000 American soldiers and almost 3 million Vietnamese die. One small problem. There never were any PT, patrol torpedo, boats. The events never happened. As Secretary of State Rusk, the President, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara knew. They knew because they planned the deception. One source for this is former Admiral James Stockdale in his book, In Love and War. On the night in question, Stockdale was at the controls of a Sabre jet flying cover for the two destroyers. He saw nothing. Another source is Ben Bradley, much respected former managing editor of the Washington Post. Bradley, in a public lecture in England in April 1987, states, "The so-called facts behind this critically important resolution were quite simply lies." August 2, 1990. Iraq attacks Kuwait, claiming the Kuwaitis are slant drilling into Iraq's oil fields. U.S. President George Bush pushes for a land war against Iraq, but polls show the U.S. public is split 50-50 on that idea. Then comes this eyewitness testimony before a congressional committee from a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl who cannot be identified for fear of reprisal.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The U.S. public is outraged. Support for land war zooms. It's a turning point. Desert Storm is launched. 135,000 Iraqis are killed. Large numbers die since from sanctions still in effect. One small problem. There never were any incubator baby deaths. Not one. The CBC's The Fifth Estate reveals the girl was the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, given her lines and coached in acting by the giant PR firm Hill & Knowlton. This was one phase of a $10 million joint U.S.-Kuwaiti campaign of deception. This man is lying.
I myself buried 40 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators.
This man is lying.
They had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
There were a lot of people in on what can fairly be described as a conspiracy of fake organizations, false documents, fraud, and disinformation. Now fast forward to a week ago Sunday. I'm watching CBC television news. The Israelis have easily intercepted a ship, for some reason, crammed openly with munitions. I'm thinking, this is fishy. Now something rare happens.
It's almost impossible that this ship would have escaped detection.
I mean, the thing is bizarre. It's crazy, and it looks like the whole thing was a setup of some sort.
Another surprise. The Globe and Mail finds the event particularly odd, and quotes a widespread Palestinian view that there's something deeply suspicious about the hugely publicized interception. Now, I'm not saying I've got inside dope to prove or disprove the munitions caper. I am saying governments concoct elaborate deceptions for political ends. I am saying that the media have been suckered many times.
Part 2 of Perspective on 9/11 consists of excerpts from three 9/11 videos. I strongly suggest you see all of these videos in their entirety, as these excerpts do not do full justice to all the information contained. The first video is titled The Great Deception and was made by Canadian journalist Barry Zwicker.
For 4 months, I've been waiting in vain for the North American media to pursue questions about the startling events of September 11th. Here's what I want to know. The multiple hijackings are unprecedented. The first occurs at 7:45 in the morning. It's a full hour before the first plane hits the World Trade Center. But it's an hour and 20 minutes, and after the second plane hits, that the president allegedly becomes informed. Think about that. Then he gives no orders. Why? He continues to listen to a student talk about her pet goat. Why? It's another 25 minutes until he makes a statement, even as Flight 77 is making a beeline for Washington, D.C. In the almost 2 hours of the total drama, not a single U.S. Air Force interceptor turns a wheel until it's too late. Why? Was it total incompetence on the part of air crews trained and equipped to scramble in minutes? Well, unlike the U.S. Air Force, I'll cut to the chase. Simply to ask these few questions is to find the official narrative, frankly, implausible. The more questions you pursue, it becomes more plausible that there's a different explanation. Namely, that elements within the top U.S. military, intelligence, and political leadership, which are closely intertwined, are complicit in what happened on September the 11th. Why U.S. complicity, you ask? Well, to stampede public opinion into supporting the so-called war on terrorism, to justify a war on Afghanistan for a future oil pipeline, the grab for Middle East oil and big budget increases for the military, and the general drive for global domination by the American empire. I know it sounds incredible, but here's some historical context from this book, Body of Secrets. Its author is James Bamford. Bamford, until recently, was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. I learned of this book on ABC's website. Bamford's information comes from interviews with, for instance, the former dean of the U.S. intelligence community and from government documents. It takes 80 pages to list Bamford's more than 600 information sources. Here's the story. It's 1962. John F. Kennedy is U.S. President. Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense. And Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer heads the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIA has failed in its illegal Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. JFK decides, Bamford writes, to back away from military solutions to the Cuban problem. But Lemnitzer, the CIA, and others at the top remain obsessed with Cuba. Writes Bamford. As the Kennedy brothers appeared to suddenly go soft on Cuba, Lemnitzer could see his opportunity to invade quickly slipping away. Attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead. Continues Bamford. Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion. Lemnitzer comes up with Operation Northwoods. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. An elaborate variation. Create an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. The duplicate would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft will have been converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. The destruction of that aircraft will be triggered by radio signal. The Cubans would be blamed. Finally, another variation is described by Bamford. On February 20, 1962, John Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral on his historic journey. Lemnitzer proposed that should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with Cuba by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. Thus, Bamford notes, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. The Operation Northwoods plan shows the Pentagon was capable, according to Bamford, of launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting a war on Cuba. Can we be sure, therefore, that complicity by the Pentagon in the events of September 11th is entirely out of the question? A common explanation as to why no U.S. military interceptors took to the skies on September 11th until it was too late is that it was simple incompetence. Well, let me deal with the incompetence theory. First, by taking you back to October 26, 1999. That is the day the chartered Learjet carrying golfer Payne Stewart crashes, killing all on board. This from the National Transportation Safety Board crash report. 9:19 a.m., the flight departs. 9:24, the Learjet's pilot responds to an instruction from air traffic control. 9:33, the controller radios another instruction. No response from the pilot. For 4.5 minutes, the controller tries to establish contact. Having failed, the controller calls in the military. Note that he did not seek, nor did he require, the approval of the President of the United States, or indeed anyone. It's standard procedure, followed routinely, to call in the Air Force when radio contact with a commercial passenger jet is lost, or the plane departs from its flight path, or anything along those lines occurs. 9:54, 16 minutes later, the F-16 reaches the Learjet at 46,000 feet and conducts a visual inspection. Total elapsed time, 21 minutes. So, what does this prove? Well, it proves that standing routines exist for dealing with all such emergencies, for instance, loss of radio contact. All personnel in the air and on the ground are trained to follow the routines, which have been fine-tuned over decades, as the Learjet incident illustrates. For large scheduled aircraft, tracked throughout on radar, to depart extravagantly from their flight paths would trigger numerous calls to the military, especially after two have hit the World Trade Center and now one is speeding toward Washington, D.C. It flies over the White House, turns sharply, and heads toward the Pentagon. Everyone, and I mean everyone, now knows these planes are very bad news. It's been reported on all TV networks for more than half an hour that this is a terrorist attack. Now, Andrews Air Force Base is a huge installation. It's home to Air Force One, the President's plane. It's home base for two combat-ready squadrons of jet interceptors, mandated to ensure the safety of the U.S. Capitol. Andrews is only 12 miles from the White House. On September 11th, the squadrons there are the 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing, equipped with F-16s, and the 321st Marine Fighter Attack Squadron of the 49th Marine Air Group Detachment A, equipped with FA-18s. This information was on the website of the base on September 11th. On September 12th, Andrews chose to update its website. I find it odd that after the update, there's no mention of the F-16 and F-18 fighters. The base becomes, according to the website, home to a transport squadron only. Yet at 6:30 the evening of September 11th, NBC Nightly News, along with many outlets, reported, it was after the attack on the Pentagon that the Air Force then decided to scramble F-16s out of the D.C. National Guard Andrews Air Force Base to fly a protective cover over Washington, D.C. Throughout the northeastern United States are many air bases. But that morning, no interceptors respond in a timely fashion to the highest alert situation. This includes the Andrews squadrons, which have the longest lead time and are 12 miles from the White House. Whatever the explanation for the huge failure, there have been no reports, to my knowledge, of reprimands. This further weakens the incompetence theory. Incompetence usually earns reprimands. This causes me to ask, and other media need to ask, if there were stand-down orders. September 11th has brought mostly unpleasant changes, including curtailment of civil liberties and threatened perpetual war, all rooted in the official story of what happened on September 11th. Namely, that one evil man and his network are responsible, and that the U.S. military, intelligence, and political establishments were all caught totally off guard. It's the duty of the media and of intelligent citizens to inquire about any anomalies about September 11th. Today's question, what did George Bush know and when did he know it on September 11th?
Bush was first informed of the suicide attacks at an education event in Florida, his face creasing into anxiety. The crisis transformed his presidency.
This image, embedded in the official story, has led the world to believe that when Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, whispered into his ear at an elementary school at 9:05 that morning, it was the first the U.S. president learned that, in his words, America was under attack. But a growing number of people, including the careful researchers at emperorsclothes.com, don't think so. Using verifiable, publicly available information, Ilarion Bykov and Jared Israel, an intrepid Canadian, raise questions mainstream media stubbornly refuse to even acknowledge. Consider, Bykov and Israel say, the words of journalist John Cochran, who was traveling with the president on the morning of September the 11th, on an ABC special report. Cochran is speaking to Peter Jennings. Peter, as you know, the president's down in Florida talking about education. He got out of his hotel suite this morning, was about to leave. Reporters saw the White House chief of staff, Andy Card, whisper into his ear. The reporter said to the president, "Do you know what's going on in New York?" He said he did, and he said he will have something about it later. His first event is about half an hour at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. So Bush knew, writes Emperor's Clothes, about the first incident before leaving his hotel. Take other evidence. By 8:20, according to its own official report, the Federal Aviation Authority, the FAA, is fully aware of the unprecedented emergency in the skies. As Bykov and Israel point out, the President of the United States travels with an entire staff, including the Secret Service, which is responsible for his safety. The members of this support team have the best communications equipment in the world. They maintain contact with, or can easily reach, Bush's cabinet, the National Military Command Center and Pentagon, the FAA. In other words, around 8:46 at the absolute latest, the Secret Service and the President would have known of all four hijacked airliners and that one had hit the World Trade Center. That's two sets of proofs that question the famous whisper in the ear at 9:05. The President tells us he saw the incredible image of the first plane going in. He went ahead with an easily cancelable appointment. Why? He tells us he knew his country was under attack, yet he continued to listen to a student talk about her pet goat and such for another 25 minutes. Why? George W. Bush is acting right here. There are many other facts equally puzzling, at least for anyone still clinging to the official story of 9/11. His schedule and whereabouts had been publicly announced. Why did the Secret Service not whisk him away for safety's sake? Do you think there's anything here that mainstream media should follow up? Have you noticed any such follow-up? Do you find this as incredible as I do? What will it take to snap people out of the hypnotic trance of the official story and start asking questions? Maybe you calling an editor and raising hell. Until the world finds out the truth about what really happened on September the 11th, the world is held hostage to the so-called war on terrorism. And surely it's time to recognize that for what it is, harsh final steps to what the U.S. military terms full-spectrum dominance. The less people ask themselves questions about deceit, the more it clears the way for organizations such as the CIA to continue to receive seemingly unending billions of dollars. Taxpayer money used to train terrorists, as the CIA acknowledges it has, to destabilize governments, as former CIA agent John Stockwell writes in his book, In Search of Enemies, and to inject toxic gray, white, and black propaganda into the world's information systems, as William Bloom spells out in Killing Hope, all with barely a whisper of dissent. Those stratagems include a relentless outpouring of myths about weapons, strategy, security, enemies, history, and human nature from government bureaucracies and adjunct think tanks and co-opted media and electronic theologians. No realm of public policy is more corrupted by untruthful speech than national security. Today, the big lie of the so-called war on terrorism, itself firmly based on the linchpin of the implausible official version of what happened on September 11th, is an even more severe test of truth, in my opinion. Under the banner of the war on terrorism, George W. Bush, with the aid of the media, zealously promotes perpetual global war in service of resource looting and permanent popularity for himself. There's unprecedented militarism. The USA is spending more than half its budget on wars past, present, and future, according to the Center for Defense Information. Peace is not a thing of weakness. It calls for heroism and action. Day by day, you must wrest it from the mouths of liars. You must stand alone against the multitude, for clamor is always on the side of the many, and the liar has ever the first word. The meek must be strong.
In September 2002, I further annoyed our government by releasing my book, Painful Questions. It provides evidence that both World Trade Center towers and Building 7 were demolished with explosives that were placed in the buildings before the attack. I also show that many of the phone calls from the passengers appear to be fake in order to deceive us into believing the airplanes had been hijacked by Arabs. I show that the terrorists were patsies in this incredible scam.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Building 7 was a 47-story building with a steel frame. No airplane crashed into it, nor did the towers fall onto it. However, this building disintegrated on September 11th. This satellite image shows the World Trade Center about a year before the attack. Building 7 is the tall building at the top. Here is a view from an airplane of the rubble of Building 7. The pile is very small. How did a 47-story steel building crumble into such a tiny pile of rubble? Our government believes that fire caused it to disintegrate. Fires erupted in Building 7 about 9 in the morning, a few moments after the plane crashed into the South Tower. The fires burned all day. This photo shows the fires at 3 p.m. The fires are not easy to see because they are small, and there's lots of dust and smoke in the air. There are only a few flames in only a few of the thousands of windows of this large building. Most floors do not have fires, and the floors that do are burning only in a few small areas. Compared to other office fires, these are small. Why didn't the sprinkler system extinguish them? This photograph shows the rear of Building 7. This side of the building doesn't have many fires either. There are no fires anywhere along the base of the building. Despite the fact that the fires in Building 7 were so small that the sprinkler system should have extinguished them, at about 5:30 in the evening, the building suddenly crumbled into a pile of rubble. How did a few little fires cause Building 7 to crumble? According to Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering, a magazine for fire departments, fire has never destroyed a steel building. So how did a fire do what it had never done before? Perhaps you wonder if incompetent architects designed this building with delicate steel beams. If so, take a look at the beam with the numeral 7 spray-painted on its end. To say the beams in Building 7 were massive would be an understatement. This building was straddling an electrical substation for the city, so it had some of the thickest steel beams of any building on the planet. At the upper left corner is a standard I-shaped beam. It would be considered massive in most buildings, but it seems delicate next to the biggest beams of Building 7. As is typical in the design of buildings, bridges, and most industrial products, Building 7 was designed with more strength than it actually needed. So how did a building with such massive steel framework disintegrate into such a tiny pile of rubble from a few tiny fires? A government agency, FEMA, conducted an investigation into why the buildings in the World Trade Center collapsed. However, the editor of Fire Engineering magazine became so disgusted by the investigation that the January 2002 issue carried an angry article in which he accused the investigation of being a half-baked farce. Later that month, both Bush and Cheney asked Tom Daschle to limit the investigation. Apparently, a half-baked farce was more of an investigation than Bush and Cheney wanted. I suppose they would have preferred a quarter-baked farce. In March 2002, the Committee on Science of the House of Representatives held a meeting to investigate the investigation. There were more insults and accusations at this meeting. For example, Congressman Bollert complained that the investigation seems shrouded in excessive secrecy. Professor Corbett complained that they were trying to run an investigation with part-time engineers and scientists and on a shoestring budget. There were also accusations that landlords and insurance companies interfered with the investigation. It seems that a lot of people were helping President Bush ruin the investigation. During April 2002, the final bits of rubble from the World Trade Center were removed. The thick pieces of steel were sold to foreign nations as scrap metal, and at a very low price, while the less valuable pieces were shipped by barge to be buried. By May 2002, the World Trade Center had been cleaned up and all the rubble destroyed, so nobody could conduct any further investigations into how the buildings collapsed. The editor of Fire Engineering wrote months earlier that this destruction of rubble is illegal. He pointed out that our laws demand rubble be saved from major disasters so that we can learn what happened and improve our buildings and fire prevention techniques. Our government violated the law when it destroyed the rubble from the World Trade Center. In May 2002, FEMA released the report on the collapse of the buildings. Not surprisingly, the report doesn't explain anything. For example, rather than explain how the fires caused Building 7 to collapse, the FEMA report has this. The specifics of the fires in Building 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Our government spent 7 months investigating the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, and at the end, they announce they have no idea what happened to Building 7. If FEMA was a private company, I would demand my money back. Since they are a government agency, their worthless report is evidence that they are involved in covering up a scam. FEMA claims that they cannot understand how Building 7 collapsed, but perhaps you and I can figure it out by watching the videos of it collapsing. Incidentally, this video is lousy because it comes from people who recorded the TV news, as with the security video that shows Flight 77 crashing into the Pentagon. Nobody wants to provide good quality video of Building 7 as it collapses. At the top of Building 7 is a rectangular penthouse that contains air conditioning and other equipment. If you recall, the fires were on the lower floors, not near the roof. However, the penthouse is the first part of the building to collapse. How could the fires cause damage to the penthouse without damaging all the floors in between? Here's a different view of the collapse. And another view. Since fire has never caused a steel building to crumble before, I guess we'll never know if this dust is typical. Now that you've seen how the building collapsed, do you think these tiny fires were responsible? If so, how did the fire destroy the entire steel structure? Building 7 collapsed in the same manner that demolition companies destroy old buildings. They use explosives to shatter the joints holding the steel beams together. The explosives are detonated in a sequence that causes the building to fall vertically downward into a tiny pile of rubble. Also, when the building is tall, the explosives are often timed to destroy the interior of the building before the exterior walls are broken, thereby causing the interior section to fall first. As the interior pieces fall, they pull the exterior walls towards the interior. This creates a small pile of rubble with the exterior walls laying on top of the rubble. Photos of the rubble from Building 7 show exactly that, namely the exterior walls on top of the interior pieces. Normally, if a 47-story steel building crumbled into a pile of rubble because of a couple of tiny fires, people around the world would be shocked and want to know what happened. Architects would be interested in understanding what happened so that they could design buildings better. People who live or work in tall buildings would wonder, can fire do this to my building? However, are any architects asking why Building 7 fell down? Are any people in tall buildings wondering if their building might also fall down? Why does nobody care that a steel building disintegrated for no apparent reason? Part of the problem is that most people simply don't know much about Building 7 due to the incredible secrecy surrounding this building. We were frequently told of the evilness of Osama and Saddam, but how often did you see the collapse of Building 7? How many articles did you find in newspapers or magazines about Building 7? The only explanation for this secrecy that I can think of is that nobody can explain how Osama caused Building 7 to collapse. By keeping this issue a secret, they are hoping that people will forget about the incident, rather than ask, what happened to Building 7? One possible reason for the secrecy about Building 7 is that it may have been the control center for demolishing the World Trade Center. The 23rd floor of this building was given $15 million worth of renovations to make it into an emergency command center for Mayor Giuliani. For example, it was given bullet and bomb-resistant windows. This particular office had its own air and water supply, and it was designed to withstand winds of 160 miles per hour. To make the situation more suspicious, the reinforcements were only for this one floor, so that meant most of the building was just an ordinary office building. Why would they protect only one floor? Furthermore, why would they need their own air supply? And how about the protection from 160 mile per hour wind? Well, consider that when the towers fell down, clouds of dust and grit were thrown outward at a very high speed. The only people protected from that blast were in this special emergency command center. Of course, the city government claims the entire building was evacuated at 9 in the morning, so nobody was inside this special reinforced bunker when the towers collapsed. This meant that the city spent $15 million to make this special reinforced bunker, and then everybody abandoned it just when it would have been useful. But did everybody really abandon Building 7? It would have been a great place for people to supervise the attack because the 23rd floor provided a wonderful view of the area, and the occupants were protected from the dust and debris. To make the situation even more suspicious, as I explain in more detail in the book, the flight paths of the two airplanes that hit the towers appear to have been on a course towards Building 7, as if this building was broadcasting a homing signal. The towers were built by the government, so taxpayers owned both of them. However, somehow the government was convinced to lease the towers for 99 years. Larry Silverstein became landlord on July 24th, less than